Welcome to Career Conversations. My name is Siobhan Murphy, a careers advisor here in DCU, and this week we're going to discuss the career choice of being a solicitor. Joining me to unpack this career choice and how to train to be a solicitor is Ian Ryan from the Law Society of Ireland. Ian is the traineeship executive with the Law Society, and his own career story is that he studied computer science after he left school and he worked in the IT industry for 9 years. Subsequently to that, he passed his FE1s, which is the entrance exam into the Law Society of Ireland, and completed a training contract in Clonmel in County Tipperary. He worked for 9 years as a solicitor in New Ross, County Wexford, prior to taking up his current role in 2016. As a solicitor, Ian worked in general practice, carrying out work in conveyancing, family law, wills and probate, litigation, including civil and criminal. So Ian, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. So I think back your background, you've had done a career transition, you have been a practicing solicitor, and now as part of the traineeship program in the Law Society, you must have great insider, outsider insights to the whole gamut of being a solicitor. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Siobhan. It's a really great opportunity to get to speak to your students today on the areas of law and qualifying as a solicitor, I suppose.
Brilliant, and thank you so much. We might just kick off, and sometimes I often find it great to maybe just kind of really stand back from the whole process of any career choice we're looking at and just ensure that we understand the jargon around the profession, but also, you know, that main constituent points and bodies involved. First of all, could you maybe just briefly outline what is the Law Society of Ireland to begin with?
Certainly. So the Law Society of Ireland is the educational, representative and regulatory body of the solicitor's profession in Ireland. It exercises statutory functions under the Solicitors Act 1954 to 2008 in relation to the education, admission, enrolment, discipline and regulation of the solicitor's profession. It is governed by an elected council of voluntary members, which is supported by a full-time executive staff led by the Director General.
Brilliant. So from what I'm hearing from that is it may be on the education, like the training of solicitors, but it's very much part and parcel of, as being a solicitor in the profession as well, all the way up till you retire. Like it's very much part of the day-to-day life of being a solicitor.
Yeah, that's quite correct. I mean, a solicitor as a professional, I suppose it's a regulated profession, as are all professions in Ireland. And the Law Society, I suppose, is responsible for training trainee solicitors and also regulating them after they qualify, if you like, as well. And that regulation now occurs hand in hand with the Legal Services Regulatory Authority.
Brilliant. So one of the things that I suppose, you know, law as a profession, you know, is definitely one of the oldest ones out there, you know. We think we know what a solicitor is and what a solicitor does. But if we were to try and explain it to somebody that never heard the phrase a solicitor, or if we had an alien landing and said, what does a solicitor do? Could you kind of unpack it a bit more for us?
Certainly. So in the first instance, what a solicitor or a good solicitor should really do is be able to help people. They help people with all different types of matters. So sometimes it might be a non-contentious matter where something is straightforward, there's no argument. You might be buying a property, for instance, or it could be helping parties where it has gone contentious, you know, when you're involved maybe in litigation or maybe you're facing a prosecution by the state. Essentially, what a solicitor does is they take very careful instructions from a client and they take in all of those inputs, all the information they're getting from the client, and then they apply their knowledge of the law to that information that they've received, and they try and come up with a remedy for their client, a solution, if you like. So the way I like to compare it is maybe to a computer program. The computer program takes in data, and it can work on that data and produce an output, but the output is only ever as good as the information that goes into the computer system. So a really important part of a solicitor's job is listening very carefully, using active listening, being able to relate to a client, show empathy and take instructions, if you like.
That's very interesting, because one of my next question really was, you know, what makes a good solicitor? So you mentioned two particular strengths or skills. There was active listening and empathy, because I suppose whether you're a business or a private individual, if you are approaching a solicitor for advice, it's something you probably just have not been able to sort out yourself. So there's some form of a crisis.
That's true. I mean, my own preference, I would much prefer a solicitor who I can relate to. And, you know, sometimes solicitors are dealing with people at the worst times of their lives. Mm-hmm. They might be going through a divorce, or they might be facing a very severe criminal prosecution. They might be very upset. They might be very worried about the situation. So in respect of what I believe makes a good solicitor, it's somebody who not necessarily has an expert knowledge of the law, but it's somebody who can take those careful instructions and relate to the client, and always to be honest with the client. So if the client seeks to instruct them in a matter in which the solicitor doesn't know very much about, they should be honest about that and perhaps refer the client on to a colleague who is an expert in that area. But, you know, first and foremost, a solicitor, just like your general practitioner doctor, it should be somebody that you can relate to and share your issues with, knowing that the conversation will be confidential.
Sure. So we often hear the phrase, you know, mitigation of risk associated with the law, reducing risk for your client. So just talk to me about that whole concept of risk. And I suppose what I'm trying to get at is, for people who are considering pursuing a career as a solicitor, and the type of personality and attributes and skills and strengths they might have, can you just talk to me about that whole area of risk?
Certainly. So in terms of advising a client in respect of any legal issue, I mean, you'll always have to assess risk. It could be, you know, somebody is considering maybe pursuing a personal injuries case, and you'll always have to advise the client, well, what would happen if you'd lose the case? You know, there's a risk involved in going to court on any proceedings. You know, there could be a risk that you could lose the case and costs could be awarded against you. So I suppose in every conversation we have with clients, you know, risk has to be assessed. It could also maybe be a client who wants a will drafted in a particular way, and maybe there's a risk that the will could be challenged because of the way the will instructions are formatted, if you like. And again, you would have to advise your client, you know, of the risks of proceeding, you know, with a will in that format, if you like. It could be somebody maybe entering into an agreement to purchase a business, and, you know, there might be some issues or outstanding litigation connected to the business. And as part of your due diligence, when you're assessing that business, again, you would have to advise your client in respect of the risks as well, if you like, you know.
Brilliant. And just that we've already started to kind of dig a little bit deeper on, say, the some of the skills and attributes there. You mentioned active listening and the you know, and empathy. So I suppose one of the words coming up for me now when I'm hearing all that is just really that whole communication suite, you know.
Communication is so important.
Yeah. So let's go through them. Do you know, so writing skills, let's talk about the writing skills that are needed and also that need to be developed, you know, over the traineeship.
Sure. So I suppose in terms of writing, I mean, the attributes you need to be an interested kind of problem solver.
Okay.
So you want to try and find the solutions to each issue as they arise. You need to be able to draft letters, certainly to your clients, and, you know, communicate in nice, clear language, not necessarily kind of highfalutin Latin terms, but, you know, basic English terminology that your clients will easily understand. So, you know, you have to be interested in reading. You could be reading a lot of case law when you're researching cases. So you just need, a good basic grasp of the English language, and to be able to communicate as clearly as possible, if you like.
And I suppose those things can be developed over a period of time. Like, you know, you don't need to be able to write like a solicitor, you know, upon leaving school, but it might be more things that you can develop during college. progress on again through your time with the Law Society. It can be crafted, really.
Yes, as part of the way they teach law at the Law Society, they have lectures, and also in respect of each subject, you have practical tutorial workshops. So on a Monday, you might have a lecture on issuing a contract for sale in relation to land law. And on a Tuesday, you might have a workshop where you're actually drafting the letter to your client and drafting the contract for sale. And all of that is done, you know, with the help of a tutor who is a qualified solicitor. So certainly, whilst you're at the law school, the training is very practical, and you'll be well equipped then when you start your training contract to practice those skills that you've learned at law school, if you like.
Brilliant, because the whole thing about it is, you know, and this is what we're going to go on to talk about, is just the roots into the profession. So many of our listeners in DCU will already have a law background, you know, that might be have already considered pursuing a career as a solicitor, but equally, bit like yourself, you started off in computer science and then made a move into the law. So can we talk to about the roots into law for anybody that's listening, you know, the route that you already have a law degree and so on, and the routes without a degree?
Certainly. So the first thing I would like to say that it's always been the case that you didn't necessarily need to have a law qualification to go on and study as a solicitor. So my own background, my degree was in computer science. And because I was the holder of that degree, I was entitled to sit the Law Society entrance exams, known as the FE1s. The system has changed since the 1st of January 2020, in that anyone who has completed the first year or subsequent year of a course leading to a qualification at level 7 on the higher national framework of qualifications, or a degree awarded by a university in England, Northern Ireland, Scotland or Wales, is now eligible to sit the FE1s. So after your first year of college, no matter what qualification you're pursuing, provided it's level 7 or higher, you are entitled to sit the FE1 exams. There are 8 papers which form the exam itself, and you can take as many or as few as you want at each sitting. So the papers that you're examined in are the following: company law, constitutional law, contract law, criminal law, European Union law, equity, land law, and tort law. There are 2 sittings per year, normally in the spring and around October. So normally March and October are the 2 sittings each year. It's €105 per subject to register for the individual exams. And from the end of December in the year in which you first pass an exam, you have 7 years in total to complete the exams. Now, hopefully it doesn't take 7 years for everyone, but you have those 7 years to pass the 8 papers.
And do you, I think in the old way anyway, I think you had to sit 3 in the first go in order to progress on to other ones. So can you speak to the changes on that since?
Yes, certainly. So that is true. In my time, when I would have sat the exams, there was a rule that you had to pass 3 for your results to count. So quite often somebody might be unfortunate. You know, they might sit 4 papers. They might pass 2 and fail 2. And then they were back to the drawing board and having to start them all over again. That is no longer the case since the 1st of January 2020. The rule now is you just need to pass 1 subject to get out of the gates, if you like, with regards to sitting the FE1s. And, you know, once you've passed 1 subject, you can go on and then sit them at your leisure. When I approached the FE1s, I sat 4 for my first sitting. I thereafter sat 2 at the next sitting and a further 2 at the next sitting after that. And at the time, I suppose I was working full-time and just studying part-time. That's the way I approached it. And touch wood, I never failed one, thankfully.
But it was tough going there, I'd say, Ian, as well, you know, to sit 4 and work full-time as well, was it?
Yeah, I suppose I used to come in after work. I'd have my dinner and I'd probably just sit down maybe from 6:30 to 9:30 studying the various course manuals for the subjects. And, you know, I used to develop memory maps to try and remember the case names and the points of each case. I probably put in maybe 100 hours study per paper. Might have been overkill, but it worked. The pass mark for each exam paper is 50%. 50%.
Okay, so there's just a couple of points that has just come up in my mind as you were explaining that. So am I right in thinking that I could, God, we don't want to put anyone under pressure thinking this way, but you could, during your college years, you know, start doing an FE1 exam here and there. Is that what you're really saying?
Yeah,
you were so inclined.
So there is earlier access now to the exams since the 1st of January, as explained, you know, once you've completed your first year of your college course. So certainly if you were studying that particular semester, you know, company or maybe contract law, you might decide then to immediately thereafter at the next sitting sit those particular FE1 papers while all of the knowledge is fresh in your mind, if you like. That might be a very good way to do it.
And can I ask you, because I've often talked to students and you know, got feedback from people who have, you know, completed the FE1s and whatever. And I suppose there's one of the things is that the exams would be quite a different type of structure than what they would have experienced while studying in college. You know, it's kind of a different process of examination. Can you maybe speak to us a little bit about, about the exams themselves, you know, the structure of them and the approach? What is the Law Society trying to assess here, really?
Yes, I suppose it's trying to assess the candidate's knowledge of the particular legal area and how well they can apply that knowledge to an example scenario. So the papers themselves, there's 8 questions on each paper, and you have to answer 5 out of the 8 questions. So there's normally a bit of choice in the papers. Typically, exam questions will present you with a legal scenario where an issue has arisen, and you have to, advise one party to that scenario. So, for instance, you might be advising a prosecutor, or you might be advising a defendant. You could be advising an employer where a workplace accident has happened, or you might be advising the employee who has been injured in the workplace. Usually the exam questions themselves contain certain clues, so it's well worth reading the questions very carefully and underlining any clues that you come across. For instance, you know, in a company law scenario, perhaps a company might be named Dodgy Dealings Limited, and that would immediately be a clue that, you know, there is something untoward as to how this company may be operating. Mm-hmm. And that's before you get into the nuts and bolts of the actual question itself. So very important to spend a few minutes looking for those clues when you're sitting the papers and just jotting down, you know, a brief summary of what areas of law you think the question is asking you about before you embark on answering the question itself, if you like.
Now, you mentioned when you were describing your own experience of completing the FE1s, you spoke to that you went home every evening and you opened up the manuals. So if I was to say to myself, right, I'm thinking of doing the FE1s come October, I am not, by the way, I'm not going to change career. But, you know, how do I go about that whole process of preparing myself? You know, is there, you know, do the Law Society, you know, give you this stuff, or do you have to buy it? Look, what happens?
Yeah, I mean, the Law Society has a website. On the website, there's a link under public qualifying as a solicitor, and everything is there that we're discussing today. With regard to me, because my background wasn't in law, I did an FE1 preparatory course. There's a number of people around the country who offer these courses. That's the way I prepared for them. The Law Society does have a recommended book list, and it also publishes the syllabus for the exam. So it is possible to study and pass the exams without doing a preparatory course, particularly, moreover, if you were a law student to begin with. I have seen people who have passed the FE1s without doing a preparatory course, if you like. But certainly for me, that was the easiest option. Now, the DIT and also the Law Society run a postgraduate diploma in law, which would prepare you for all 8 exams as well. They cover all the subjects that form the FE1s, if you like.
Yeah, so that might be very useful for somebody that has no background in law and would really love, you know, a more deeper preparatory course than an FE1 course. Is that what you're saying there? Kind of much more deeper?
Yeah. Somebody who wasn't a law graduate, it might be useful in 2 respects. Number one, it's going to give them a qualification.
Sure.
And number two, then it's going to prepare them for the exams. So they might find that they get better value for money proceeding by that method rather than just doing a preparatory course, if you like, and not get a separate qualification out of their study, if you like, you know?
Yeah, and students have often asked me about, you know, should I do a preparatory course? And I've kind of responded something more similar to yourself. I think it comes down to your own personality and how you like to learn. And do you learn better in a classroom setting, you know, having a kind of a rollout of a number of weeks of a preparatory course? Linking up with people doing a similar thing can be very, very useful to some people. And other people just genuinely say, listen, I just love going home, opening up the door myself and just killing the books myself. My way of learning, I'd prefer to work on my own. So it very much depends maybe from your starter knowledge and just knowing yourself quite well about how you learn and how you thrive in those or not thrive in, as the case may be, in around examinations and things like that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I believe the preparatory course, what it does is it summarises, I suppose, the most important parts of the legal textbooks. So certainly you could read the textbooks yourself. Once you have an idea of what type of questions come up on the papers. And in that regard, you can get past papers from the Law Society, which is very useful. So you can get past papers and also examiner reports for the exams as well. So they can give you very useful clues as to what typically comes up on the exams each year. It's important, you know, that your studies are wide enough that you don't leave yourself with too few topics with regard to the exam papers. But it also, it's a good way to be prepared for the exam just by knowing previous exams and the form of same, if you like.
So from our listeners' perspective, they probably, you know, if they knew very little about this process before listening to this episode, probably one of the gaps or probably one of the alarm bells that's coming up for people is that, you know, I might do a degree of some kind. I can do these FE1s. I'm hearing that, you know, people seem to sit them not necessarily one go, although I do know some students that do give all eight a go and some successfully pass eight in one sitting. But generally people do split them up into at least two sittings, if not more. So if I was a potential person for being a solicitor, I'm just hearing that there's kind of a gap emerging now. You know, what do I do when I'm, you know, the gap between, say, college and beginning, you know, my career again as a solicitor. So what is, in your own experiences, what do people generally do, Ian, in that time?
I suppose, you know, after college, if they were going to embark on the FE1s, they'd probably pick the papers that they're most interested in. Mm-hmm. So I particularly enjoy criminal law. So I found that a very interesting paper to study for. And because I was interested, it wasn't a labour, if you like, carrying out the studies. Also contract law, I found quite interesting, quite straightforward. So I suppose for your first sitting of the exam, to make it interesting for yourself, you should really play to your strengths and pick the particular subjects that you're really interested in. And it's a matter then of deciding, you know, whether you're going to give them a try and see, can you manage maybe without doing a preparatory course and just having a go at the paper, being well prepared, presenting your answer very clearly. With the style of these papers, they're more accustomed to kind of bullet point answers where you're giving very practical advice rather than beautiful long essays on law, if you like. So it's that very practical nature of the exams that you just need to get your head around. And the fact, if you'd like, you can compare it to me sitting in the office advising a client, and I have to write out to the client after the meeting. I will be writing a very detailed letter with the very practical advice set out, if you like, in bullet point form in the letter. And that's the way those answers should probably be approached as well in the exam.
And brilliant. And listen, once people finish college and there is going to be a time lapse in between that and starting with the Law Society, there's nothing stopping anybody going out and getting work as a legal assistant in a law firm. I suppose to, first of all, develop their understanding and whether they want to actually pursue a career as a solicitor. It's a very practical thing to do. It might help you motivate yourself to go and do those FE1 exams. And then also you're probably getting some of that more practical experience that might help you with actually doing the FE1s also.
So that's very very true. That happened in my own case. I was working in the computer department in Dell Computers, and I was able to get a legal placement one day a week in their legal department, if you like. And certainly I got knowledge through that role, but also it enabled me to put that little piece of work experience on my CV. And I believe that was what made the difference in me obtaining my training contract. So every year we run a seminar on finding your training contract, typically late January, early February. And we get existing law students who are on the professional practice courses to give talks on how they found their training contract. And every year what we find is usually getting that first little bit of work experience in law is a stepping stone, if you like. And that is what leads to finding the training contract eventually. So it's a really important to get relevant work experience and see what relevant skills you have to offer an employer.
And for our DCU listeners, we have an excellent program for law students that is run in conjunction with the DCU alumni, the School of Law and Government, and the Career Service itself. So what we have is a graduate-to-graduate mentoring program for law graduates, and it's to assist those new law graduates. You know, they're just finished, say, if we go on this timeline, that they're just finished their exams now this year. And then come September, we will link them with existing alumni in their first year out of college. And when they're negotiating that space of maybe considering doing their FE1s, maybe trying to secure a traineeship, also, you know, securing even a role as a legal assistant work, you know, just to kind of help navigate that space. And it's been a fantastic resource to our early law graduates, and our alumni have been stunning in their outreach back to the current, you know, the new graduates each year. And I think they've really, really, really added to, you know, the whole pursuance of a career as a solicitor or any aspect of the legal field. The mentoring program is not limited to pursuing a career as a solicitor. It could be, you know, go maybe working in the Defence Forces. You might want to go to Garda Síochána. You know, there might be the application of the law, you know, as a career that you want to pursue, you know, or governance or anything like that. So it's broader than being a solicitor or a barrister, but that's one of the programs that we have here in DCU. So let's go through it. So we've decided we want to be a solicitor. We've done our FE1s. There is this securing of a traineeship that you've alluded to, and obviously all the law firms advertise as well. You have some, you know, there is a resource through the Law Society. I understand that, you know, if you're seeking a traineeship by the, if you haven't secured a traineeship by the time you begin in the Law Society. So I suppose what I'm hearing really strong and hard from you, you can't really start your education as a solicitor without securing a traineeship. Can you speak to that whole education and professional setting contract there?
Certainly. So there is a rule that you must have a training contract to register for the first solicitor's course known as Professional Practice Course 1 or PPC 1. The Law Society has a legal vacancies website. It's legalvacancies.ie. So from time to time, training contracts are advertised there. Also, on the Law Society website, there's a register of training firms. So it's a voluntary register where firms who are interested in taking on trainee solicitors from year to year will join that register, and their contact details are displayed on same. So if you like, it gives students, you know, a good lead as to where might take them on, if you like. There's also a facility to upload your CV to the Law Society website when you're looking for a training contract. And those CVs are kept securely and are accessible by members of the profession. So you'd have to be a solicitor to be able to go in and view those CVs. So sometimes that has worked for people obtaining training contracts as well. Many of the large firms take law students in on internships. So some are internships, and with some firms, they only recruit their trainee solicitors from that population of interns, if you like. So an internship is a very good way of starting a career in law. And I definitely recommend that students pursue those options, if you like. With regard to finding the training contract, the requirement is that your training solicitor must have held a practicing certificate in Ireland for at least 4 years. So at some stage during their career, they must have obtained 4 years practice experience in Ireland. They must be a partner or the sole practitioner in the firm. So they have to have an ownership interest in the firm if it's private practice. And, you know, what occurs is there's a form called a Form 1 and a Form 2 that are available on the Law Society website that are completed by the trainee or the proposed trainee solicitor and the training solicitor. And they are submitted to the Law Society. And if you like, that's an application to have the training contract approved by the Law Society.
Brilliant. So the if your intake into the Law Society, it happens each year in September, October, or is that your, what's your academic year?
Yeah, certainly. So Professional Practice Course 1 normally commences in September each year and it runs to mid-March. And the training contract itself then is 24 months long and it starts 14 days after the last exam on Professional Practice Course 1. We also offer a hybrid Professional Practice Course 1, which is a part-time course and distance learning course, if you like. And that starts each year with registration in December and it runs until the following November. And the difference with that course is, if you like, it follows the exact same syllabus, but you only need to attend at Blackhall Place once per month for a weekend of workshops, which run from Friday afternoon to Sunday afternoon. And thereafter, you have to attend a week of workshops at Easter time and at August time. So that could really suit somebody maybe with children or maybe someone who's working full time and, you know, is not in a position to give up a job and go to the Law Society for full-time study.
Or just somebody just pure distance, you know, living in the west of Ireland or like even 60 miles away, like it's hard to get into the city all the time. So you have, you know, an in-classroom experience and you go full-time for that block. People, I think, are familiar with the phrase kind of block release. You're kind of in for a block and then you're out again, isn't that it? Back into your firm. Or you can do this hybrid where you could remain in your firm or in another part of Ireland or whatever else you're doing, or a bit like you, maybe even studying, you know, working in IT and then move into it.
Yes, certainly. So that's a very useful options, I suppose, that are there. Also, you know, even prior to starting the professional practice course, if you've obtained legal work experience under the direction of a practicing solicitor in Ireland in the 12 months before starting the PPC1 course, you can obtain 4 months credit off your 24-month training contract. So that's another really
terrific
practical reason, I suppose, for obtaining work experience prior to starting the professional practice course.
Now, who funds this? You know, like, you know, tell me about that. You know, we're not going to Blackhall Place for free now. Well, how does the fees work?
Certainly. So I've told you about the €105 per subject for the FE1. There's an application fee when you're having your training contract approved of €840. The fee for Professional Practice Course 1 is €8,300. And the fee for the follow-up course, Professional Practice Course 2, is €4,500. Thankfully, the courses are approved for SUSE funding. So if you're entitled to a SUSE grant, it'd be well worth your while applying for same. The standard grant in total is €2,000 for both PPC1 and PPC2. So that's split between PPC1 and PPC2. SUSE paid two-thirds of that grant for PPC1. So two-thirds of 2,000 for PPC1 and the remaining one-third for PPC2.
But do training firms pay, you know, if you do get a training contract, what's the norm there?
Sure. So that's a very good question. So in Dublin, the large firms would pay the fees for Blackhall Place. And also, if you had worked with the firm prior to starting PPC1, they will also pay you whilst you're on the course, which is very useful. So medium-sized firms, perhaps in Dublin, may also do that. And typically outside of Dublin, you would find that the firms may not be in a position to pay your fees whilst on Blackhall Place. So,
Is there any other supports besides SUSE? Is there any scholarships or anything like
that? So there's a couple of scholarships available. the Dublin Solicitors Bar Association offer a bursary, so kind of a maintenance fund for law students wishing to pursue the qualification of solicitor. Also, the Law Society itself runs an access scholarship program. That program is aimed at students, law students in particular, who would have been access students at college. It's a follow-on program for students who were access at college. Also, it does accept applications from students who might not have necessarily been access at college, but feel they would be eligible under the access criteria. So those criteria, when we're looking at applications, what's assessed is income, whether a student might be in possession of a medical card, whether the family itself are in receipt of any means-tested social welfare payment. It might look at the socioeconomic group of the family. So, you know, whether it was, you know, typical that family members would have gone to college or whether it would be very much the exception that a family member would go to college. It would look at whether the candidate had gone to a DESH school, so a school maybe in a disadvantaged area. And it would also look at the area where the student came from, just to see what the poverty level is like in that particular area. They're the main criteria that are used to assess the applications, if you like.
So how long is the process between, say, starting in Blackhall Place and you have to go in to do PCP1 and you have to do PCP2, isn't that correct?
Yeah, so how long is it? I suppose the course itself, PCP1 full-time, you know, it runs from September to March.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first batch of full-time training, if you like. So it's approximately probably 7 months there that you're spending in Blackhall Place, or maybe 6 months. And thereafter, then, you're completing your 24-month training contract. So roughly about 30 months prior to you being able to apply to join the role of solicitors. And as I say, you might have accrued some credit, maybe a maximum of 4 months prior to starting the PPC1 course. So you're looking at that type of commitment time-wise.
But I suppose you're kind of working alongside it as well, so it probably doesn't feel as long maybe, or I'd hope it wouldn't feel as long anyway.
No, that's very true. I mean, it's very interesting when you're learning and applying your job, your skills on the job. A very important part of the training of a solicitor is what you actually learn in the office. I would say it's at least 50% as important as the actual professional practice courses as well. And typically, particularly in larger firms, you might be rotated through different departments. So you might spend 3 or 4 months in, you know, a land department, and thereafter you might be transferred to a company law department or maybe to a civil litigation department.
So we often hear the phrase seats, you know, what seat are you on?
Yeah.
So can you speak to, because I suppose I also like to, you know, unpack jargon associated with a career as well. So when people talk about seats, what are they talking about?
Yeah, so a seat essentially is that rotation. So it's a period of time working, you know, under the direction of a particular partner in a particular department. So that's all that a seat is. So as I say, you could have a seat or a rotation in litigation, maybe land law, maybe corporate law, employment law. There could be all different sections within a large law firm, you know, where you would rotate through those different departments. And that's what those individual seats are, if you like.
Brilliant.
With a slightly smaller firm, you might be working essentially in several different departments at the same time, because there might be only the one solicitor that you're working under. And that is where you get a very good grasp of general practice skills, if you like. So there are advantages to working in a smaller practice as well as disadvantages. And there are also advantages, of course, working in a larger firm. So as part of obtaining your work experience, that's a good opportunity to establish what type of law do you wish to practice and what type of firm are you really interested in working in. For me, I always wanted to work in general practice, and I always wanted to work down the country, and that's why I pursued my training contract in Clonmel, County Tipperary, if you like.
So it's also important to be thinking about your wider life satisfaction, you know, about where you maybe want to live, you know, where do you have a sense of what type of practice you want to, I suppose, practice in, I suppose, and earn a living from.
Yes, very important, particularly if you're interested maybe in moving from Dublin down the country, you know, or vice versa. You want to make sure that the skills you're learning are transferable and that there will be work in that area law in your community, I suppose.
Yeah. Just from your own perspective, because you have, I suppose, such a wealth and depth of experience yourself as an individual, making all these different variety of career decisions you've made yourself, and you have that, I suppose, insider insights as well. What would be your top tip to your to the listeners that are considering pursuing a career as a solicitor?
I suppose really is to get some work experience and see if you like it, see if you enjoy it, and then decide, is this thing something that you're interested in pursuing, and is it something that you could work at for the rest of your life? I mean, you know, to enjoy a job and to do a job well, you really have to be interested in it and enjoy the challenge of it. So really just to get that piece of work experience and then to try and see what are the particular areas of law that you really like and try and pursue them then, I suppose. That would be the main tip, I suppose, just the work experience.
And just something that occurred to me that I actually meant to ask you earlier is that, you know, some of the people that I meet that are very interested in pursuing a career in law, I suppose, is that there's niche aspects of law that are not always that easy to practice, you know, or that there's not enough of a trade in, you know, like, you know, that, you know, students often express, you know, interests in particular niche areas like human rights law, you know, that it's just that whole thing. Can you speak to that kind of that more general versus niche practice areas?
So I suppose as part of my role with the Law Society, I visit about 10% of the trainees every year, and I visit them all around Ireland. And I suppose in recent years, the landscape, even for small practitioners in Ireland, has changed. So sometimes, you know, you might have a solicitor deciding, you know, doing general practice mightn't necessarily be profitable for them, and they might decide to go down a more boutique route where they're specialising in the areas of law that they're particularly strong in. So this year, I visited some firms down the country, and they might only be doing litigation or only doing employment law. You know, they decided to specialise. So that's certainly happening around the country, that firms are...
So it's not just the purvey of the bigger firms, you know, to have an expertise in an area as maybe, you know, as a small practice, or would it, you know, a small practice, maybe three or four solicitors, that you can kind of develop this more boutique service as well.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I visited one firm on the west coast of Ireland last year, and they were practicing in the area of surrogacy law, which I thought
interesting.
Was amazing. Yeah, I mean, to visit a small practice, you know, in a rural town, and this is what they were kind of specialising in. Another firm then in the west, you know, specialising in employment law and advocating on behalf of clients all around Ireland at employment law hearings, if you like. So again, very interesting niche market, if you like, and I suppose because they're doing the same area of law all the time, they're getting that real expertise knowledge from experience and getting a good name for themselves as being experts in that area. I suppose last year as well, we would have seen with the HSE cases related to cancer misdiagnosis. I mean, we've seen in those instances when we watch the 6-1 news, many times it's particular law firms again and again are representing those particular unfortunate plaintiffs, if you like. And again, they're building up their specialist knowledge. So I know in rural Tipperary, one of those practitioner works. And again, they're specialising just in kind of litigation and in particular medical negligence.
Excellent. So you're only really limited by your own imagination, really, on this, that, you know, you might have to build up a practice for a while, and then you know, it could be just a happenstance of an opportunity comes up and you build out a competency in that area. Or, you know, I suppose one of the key things that I suppose is that we all have to remember that if you're setting up a practice is to consider, you know, what is your business plan here?
Yeah, that's very true. And, you know, I suppose that's what you have to really consider. You have to consider what is going to differentiate yourself from every other solicitor in your locality. What are you particularly good at? You know, what can you charge a reasonable fee on that's going to keep you paid and keep the business running as well? So, you know.
And as part of the education in the Law Society, or CPD, you know, continuous professional development in the Law Society, what about that aspect of, you know, law being a business, you know?
Yeah, certainly. So the professional practice course too, which currently runs for approximately 11 weeks in your second year of training. As part of that, the students as a team develop a business law plan to start solicitor's practice, if you like, and they look at commercial aspects of the business. So that's a very useful guide in terms of assisting a person who's thinking about starting a business. Also, students are trained in accountancy with regards to solicitor's accounts. It's a very important aspect of running the business as well. So, you know, it's very practical, again, the nature of the instruction that you get during that course with regards to those areas of setting up and running a business.
That's been fantastic, Ian. I really enjoyed talking with you today. I think our listeners will get a lot of insights, you know, maybe some of those, you know, the little nuggets that, you know, they didn't quite understand, or it seemed to be a bit of a grey area. And I think there's lots of resources there that they can access through the Law Society as well. You mentioned there's webinars and so on and so forth. And obviously for DCU students, you know, at any stage they can, I suppose, connect in with us in the career service if they need any particular advice about pursuing or guidance about pursuing a career in as a solicitor. Thank you very much for your contributions today.
Thank you, Siobhan. I really enjoyed it. Thanks very much. Best of luck.